We can predict to within 24 hours, one way or the other, when an order will leave the plant.
Yes, I've seen something like this floating around. These are the dates?
Of course.
This is impressive.
As you can see by comparing a few recently shipped orders with ones of a month or so before, our production lead times have condensed dramatically. 4 months lead time is no longer a holy number with us. From the day you sign the contract with the customer to the day we ship, the current average is about 2 months. Now tell me, do you think that could help us in the marketplace?
Sure it could.
Then how about 4 weeks?
What? Hell, don't be ridiculous. 4 weeks?
We can do it.
Come on. Last winter, when demand for every damn thing we make was way down, we were promising delivery in 4 months, and it was taking 6. Now, you're telling me you can go from contract to finished product in 4 weeks?
I wouldn't be here talking to you if we couldn't.
Come on.
Hoping desperately that we're right. Johnny, the truth is I need more business. With our overdues gone and our current backlog declining, I've got to get more work into my plant. Now, we both know the business is out there. It's just that the competition is getting more of it than we are.
You can really turn around an order of 200 Model 12s or 300 DBD-50s in 4 weeks.
Try me. Get me 5 orders. Hell, get me 10 orders, and I'll prove it to you.
And what happens to our credibility if you can't come through?
Flustered, I look down through the glass table. Johnny, I'll make a bet with you. If I don't deliver in 4 weeks, I'll buy you a brand new pair of Gucci's.
Okay, you're on. I'll pass the word to the salespeople that on all your products, we're offering terms of factory shipment in 6 weeks.
Yeah, we can do it in 4, though.
I know you're confident, but if you ship any new orders in less than 5 weeks, I'll buy you a new pair of shoes.
Chapter 29.
A full moon is shining through the bedroom window and into my eyes. The night is still. I look at the clock beside me, which says it's 4:20 a.m., Next to me in bed, Julie is sleeping. Resting on my elbow, I look down at Julie. With her dark hair spilled out on the white pillow, she looks nice sleeping in the moonlight. I watch her for a while. I wonder what her dreams are like. When I woke up, I was having a nightmare. It was about the plant. I was running up and down the aisles, and Bill Peach was chasing me in his crimson Mercedes. Every time he was about to run me over, I'd duck between a couple of machines or hop on a passing forklift. He was yelling at me from the window about my bottom line not being good enough. Finally, he trapped me in the shipping department. I had my back against stacks of cardboard cartons, and the Mercedes was racing toward me at 100 miles an hour. I tried to shield my eyes from the blinding headlights. Just as Peach was about to get me, I woke up and discovered that the headlights were moonbeams on my face. Now I'm too much awake and too aware of the problem I was trying to forget this past evening with Julie for me to fall back to sleep. Not wanting to awaken Julie with my restlessness, I slip out of bed. The house is all ours tonight. We started out this evening with nothing particular to do, when we remembered we had a whole house in Barrington with nobody in it to bother us. So we bought a bottle of wine, some cheese, and a loaf of bread, came here and got comfortable. From the living room window where I stand in the dark looking out, it seems as though the whole world is asleep except me. I'm angry with myself at not being able to sleep, but I can't let go of what's on my mind. Yesterday we had a staff meeting. There was some good news and some bad news. Actually, there was a lot of good news. High among the headlines were the new contracts marketing has been winning for us. We've picked up about half a dozen new orders since I talked to Johnny. More good news was the fact that efficiencies have gone up, not down, as a result of what we've been doing in the plant. After we began withholding the release of materials and timing the releases according to the completed processing of heat treat and the NCX-10, efficiencies dipped somewhat. But that was because we were consuming excess inventories. When the excess inventories were exhausted, which happened quickly as a result of the increase in throughput, efficiencies came back up again. Then, 2 weeks ago, we implemented the new smaller batch sizes. When we cut batch sizes in half for non-bottlenecks, efficiencies stayed solid, and now it seems as though we're keeping the workforce even more occupied than before. That's because a really terrific thing has happened. Before we reduced batch sizes, it wasn't uncommon for a work center to be forced idle because it didn't have anything to process, even though we were wading through excess inventory. It was usually because the idle work center had to wait for the one preceding it to finish a large batch of some item. Unless told otherwise by an expediter, the materials handlers would wait until an entire batch was completed before moving it. In fact, that's still the case. But now that the batches are smaller, the parts are ready to be moved to the next workstation sooner than they were before. What we had been doing many times was turning a non-bottleneck into a temporary bottleneck. This was forcing other work centers downstream from it to be idle, which reflected poorly on efficiencies. Now, even though we've recognized that non-bottlenecks have to be idle periodically, there is actually less idle time than before. Since we cut batch sizes, work is flowing through the plant more smoothly than ever. And it's weird, but the idle time we do have is less noticeable. It's spread out in shorter segments. Instead of people hanging around with nothing to do for a couple of hours, now they'll have maybe a few 10 to 20 minute waits through the day for the same amount of work. From everybody's standpoint, that's much better. Still more good news is that inventories are at their lowest ever in the plant. It's almost shocking to walk out into the plant now. Those stacks and piles of parts and sub-assemblies have shrunk to half their former size. It's as if a fleet of trucks had come and hauled everything away, which is, in fact, about what happened. We've shipped the excess inventory as finished product. Of course, the notable part of the story is that we haven't filled the plant back up again by dumping new work in process on the floor. The only work in process out there now is for current demand. But then there's the bad news, which is what I'm thinking about when I hear footsteps on the carpet behind me in the dark.
Al?
Yeah.
How come you're out here in the dark?
Can't sleep.
What's wrong?
Nothing.
Then why don't you come back to bed?
I'm just thinking about some things. For a moment, I think she's gone away. Then I feel her beside me.
Is it the plant?
Yeah.
But I thought everything was getting better. What's wrong?
It has to do with our cost measurement.
Why don't you tell me about it?
Sure, you want to hear about it?
Yes, I do.
So I tell her. The cost of parts looks as though it's gone up because of the additional setups necessitated by the smaller batch sizes.
Oh, I guess that's bad, right?
Politically speaking, yes. Financially speaking, it doesn't make a damn bit of difference.
How come?
Well, do you know why it looks like the cost has gone up?
No, not at all.
I get up to switch on a lamp and find a piece of paper and pencil. Okay, I'll give you an example. Suppose we have a batch of 100 parts. The time to set up the machine is 2 hours, or 120 minutes. And the process time per part is 5 minutes. So we've invested per part 5 minutes plus 2 hours of setup divided by 100. It comes to 1.2 minutes of setup per part. According to the accountants, the cost of the part is based upon direct labor of 6.2 minutes. Now, if we cut the batch in half, we still have the same amount of setup time. But it's spread over 50 parts instead of 100. So now we've got 5 minutes of process time plus 2.4 minutes of setup for a grand total of 7.4 minutes of direct labor. And the calculations are all based on the cost of direct labor. Then, I explained the way costs are calculated. First, there is the raw material cost. Then there is the cost of direct labor. And finally, there is burden, which essentially works out to be cost of the direct labor multiplied by a factor, in our case of about 3. So on paper, if the direct labor goes up, the burden also goes up.
So with more setups, the cost of making parts goes up.
It looks that way, but in fact, it hasn't really done anything to our actual expenses. We haven't added more people to the payroll. We haven't added any additional cost by doing more setups. In fact, the cost of parts has gone down since we began the smaller batch sizes.
Down? How come?
Because we've reduced inventory and increased the amount of money we're bringing in through sales. So the same burden, the same direct labor cost, is now spread over more product. By making and selling more product for the same cost, our operating expense has gone down, not up.
How could the measurement be wrong?
The measurement assumes that all of the workers in the plant are always going to be fully occupied. And therefore, in order to do more setups, you have to hire more people. That isn't true.
What are you going to do?
I look up at the window. The sun is now over the roof of my neighbor's house. I reach over for her hand. What am I going to do? I'm going to take you out to breakfast. When I get to the office, Lou walks in. More bad news for me?
Look, I think I can help you out on this cost of products thing.
Yeah? Like how?
I can change the base we're using for determining the cost of parts. Instead of using the cost factor of the past 12 months, which is what I'm supposed to be doing, We can use the past 2 months. That will help us because for the past 2 months, we've had big increases in throughput.
Yeah. Yeah, that might work. And actually, the past 2 months are a lot more representative of what's really going on here than what happened last year.
Well, yes, that's true, but according to accounting policy, it's not valid.
Okay, but we have a good excuse. The plant is different now. We're really a hell of a lot better than we were.
Al, the problem is Ethan Frost will never buy it.
Then why did you suggest it?
Frost won't buy it if he knows about it.
I see.
I can give you something that will slide through on the first glance, but if Frost and his assistants at Division do any checking, they'll see through it in no time.
You're saying we could end up in very hot water.
Yeah, but if you want to take a chance.
It could give us a couple more months to really show what we can do. I get up and walk around for a minute, turning this over in my mind. There's no way I can show Peach an increase in the cost of parts and convince him the plant is better off this month than last. If he sees these numbers and gets the idea our costs are going up, we'll be in hot water anyway.
So you want to try it?
Sure.
All right. Remember, if we get caught...
Don't worry. I'll practice my tap dancing. As Lou is on his way out, Fran buzzes me to say Johnny Johns is on my line. We're practically old pals by now. I've been on the phone with him just about every day, and sometimes 3 or 4 times a day for the past few weeks. Hello there. What can I do for you today?
I remember our dear friend Bucky Burnside.
How could I forget good old Bucky? Is he still complaining about us?
No, not anymore. At the moment, in fact, we don't have a single active contract with Burnside's people. That's the reason I'm calling. For the first time in months, they've expressed interest in buying something from us again.
What are they interested in?
Model 12s. They need 1,000 units.
Terrific.
Well, maybe not. They need the whole order by the end of the month.
That's only 2 weeks away.
Yeah, I know. The sales rep on this already checked the warehouse. Turns out we've only got 50 of the Model 12s in stock.
He's telling me, of course, we'll have to manufacture the other 950 by the end of the month if we want the business. Well, Johnny, look, I know I told you I wanted business, and you've pulled in some nice contracts since I talked to you. But 1,000 Model 12s in 2 weeks, that's asking a lot.
Al, to tell you the truth, I didn't really think we could do anything with this one when I called. But I thought I'd let you know about it, just in case you knew something I didn't. After all, 1,000 units means a little over $1 million in sales to us.
Yes, I realize that. Look, what's going on that they need these things so fast? He tells me he did some digging and found out that the order had originally gone to our number one competitor, who makes a product similar to the Model 12. The competitor had had the order on its books for about 5 months, but they hadn't filled it yet, and this week it became clear that they would not be able to meet the due date.
Well, my guess is that Burnside turned to us because they've heard about us offering such fast turnaround to everyone else. Frankly, I think they're desperate. And hell, if there's any way we can pull this off, it'd sure be a good way for us to save face with them.
Well, I don't know. I'd like that business back again, too, but...
The real kick in the head is if we only had the foresight to build a finished goods inventory of Model 12s while we had those slow sales months. We really could have made this sale.
I have to smile to myself because at the beginning of the year, I might have agreed with that.
It's too bad. Aside from the initial business, it would have been a big opportunity for us.
How big?
Strong hints have been dropped that if we come through on this one, we could become their preferred supplier.
All right. You really want this, don't you?
So bad I can taste it. But if it's impossible...
When do you have to let him know?
Probably sometime today or tomorrow at the latest. Why? Do you think we can really do it?
Maybe there's a way. Let me see how we stand, and I'll give you a call back. As soon as I get off the phone with Johns, I round up Bob, Stacy, and Ralph for a meeting in my office. And when we're all together, I tell them what Johns told me. Ordinarily, I would think this is out of the question. But before we say no, let's think about it. Everybody looks at me with a certain knowledge that this is going to be a waste of time. Let's just see what we can do, okay? For the rest of the morning, we're busy with this. We go over the bill of material. Stacy checks on raw materials inventories. Ralph does a quick estimate on how long it will take to produce 1,000 units after the materials are on hand. By 11 o'clock, he has calculated that the bottlenecks can turn out parts for the Model 12 at the rate of about 100 per day.
So yes, it would be technically feasible for us to do the order, but that's only if we work on nothing else for 2 weeks except the 1,000 units for Burnside.
Nah, I don't want to do that. Screwing up relations with 12 customers just to please one. Let's try something else.
Like what?
Bob is sitting there with us, looking about as enthusiastic as a bump on a log. A few weeks ago, we cut our batch sizes by half, and the result was we could condense the time inventory spends in the plant, which also gave us an increase in throughput. What if we cut the batch sizes by half again?
Gee, I hadn't thought of that.
Cut them again? Oh, sorry, Al, but I don't see how the heck that can help us, not with the volume we're already committed to.
You know, we have quite a few orders we'd plan to ship ahead of their due dates. We could reschedule some of those in the priority system so they'd ship when promised instead of early. That could give us more time available on the bottlenecks, and it wouldn't hurt anybody.
Good point, Ralph.
But hell, we still can't get 1,000 units done, no how. Not in 2 weeks.
Well, then, if we cut the batch sizes, how many units can we do in 2 weeks and still ship our current orders on time?
Well, I guess I could look into it.
I'll see what I can find out.
Hey, maybe I better go with you so we can noodle this thing out together.
While Ralph and Bob are wrestling with this new possibility, Stacy enters with news about inventories. She's ascertained we can obtain all the materials we need, either from our own stocks or from vendors within a few days, with one exception.
The electronic control modules for the Model 12 are a problem. We don't have enough of this type in stock, and we don't have the technology to build them in-house. But we've located a vendor in California who has them. Unfortunately, the vendor can't promise a shipment of that quantity in less than 4 to 6 weeks, including shipping. I'd say we might as well forget it.
Wait a minute, Stacy. We're thinking about a little change in strategy. How many modules could they give us per week? And how soon could they ship the first week's quantity to us?
I don't know, but doing it that way, we might not be able to get a volume discount.
Why not? We'd be committing to the same 1,000 units. It's just that we'd be staggering the shipments.
Well, then there's the added shipping cost.
Stacy, we're talking $1 million in business here.
Okay, but they'll take at least 3 days to a week to get here by truck.
So why can't we have them shipped air freight? They're not very big parts.
Well, I don't know, but
look into it. But I doubt if the air freight bill is going to eat up the profit on $1 million sale. And if we can't get these parts, we can't get the sale.
All right, I'll see what they can do.
At the end of the day, the details are still being sweated out, but we know enough for me to place a call to Johns. I've got a deal on those Model 12s for you to relay to Burnside.
Really? You want to take on the business?
Under certain conditions. First of all, there's no way we can deliver the full 1,000 units in 2 weeks, but we can ship 250 per week to them for 4 weeks.
Well, okay, they might go for that. But when can you start shipping?
2 weeks from the day they give us the order.
Are you sure about this?
The units will ship when we say they will.
You're that confident?
Yep.
Okay, all right. I'll call them and I'll see if they're interested. But Al, I just hope what you're telling me is real, because I don't want to go through all the hassles we had before with these people.
A couple of hours later, my phone rings at home.
Al, we got it! We got the order!
And in my mind, I hear $1 million ring up on the cash register.
And you know what? They even like the smaller shipments better than getting all 1,000 units at once.
Okay, great. I'll get the ball rolling right away. You can tell them that 2 weeks from today, we'll ship the first 250.
Chapter 30.
At the beginning of the new month, we have a staff meeting. Everyone is present except Lou. Bob tells me he'll be in shortly. I sit down and fidget. To get the meeting rolling while we're waiting for Lou, I ask about shipments. How's Burnside's order coming along?
Well, the first shipment went out as scheduled.
What about the rest of it?
No problems to speak of.
Okay.
The control boxes were a day late, but there was time enough for us to assemble without delaying the shipment. We got this week's batches from the vendor on time.
Good. What's the latest on the smaller batches?
The flow through the shop's even better now.
Excellent. Just then, Lou comes into the meeting. He's late because he was finishing the figures for this month. He sits down and looks straight at me. Well, did we get our 15%?
No. We got 17%, thanks in part to Burnside. And the coming month looks just fine.
Then he goes into a wrap-up of how we performed through the second quarter. We're now solidly in the black. Inventories are about 40% of what they were 3 months ago. Throughput has doubled. Well, we've come a long way, haven't we?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sitting on my desk when I got back from lunch the next day are two crisp, white envelopes with the Uniware division logo in the upper left corner. I open one and unfold the stiff stationery. The body of the letter is only two short paragraphs, with Bill Peach's signature on the bottom. It's congratulating us on the Burnside business. Tearing open the other, I find it too is from Peach. It too is short and to the point. It formally directs me to prepare for a performance review of the plant, which is to be held at headquarters. The smile I had from reading the first letter broadens. 3 months ago, that second letter would have dunked me into dread, because although it doesn't say so directly, I presume the review will be the occasion for determining the future of the plant. I was expecting some kind of formal evaluation, and now I'm no longer dreading it. On the contrary, I welcome it. What do we have to worry about? Hell, this is an opportunity to show what we've done. Throughput is going up as marketing spreads the word about us to other customers. Inventories are a fraction of what they were, and still falling. With more business and more parts over which to spread the costs, operating expenses down, we're making money. The following week, I'm away from the plant for 2 days with my personnel manager, Scott Dolan. We're at an off-site, very confidential meeting in St. Louis with the division's labor relations group and the other plant managers. Most of the discussion is about winning wage concessions from the various unions. It's a frustrating session for me. At Barrington, we don't particularly need to lower wages, so I'm less than enthusiastic about much of the strategy suggested, knowing it could lead to problems with the union, which could lead to a strike, which could kill the progress we've been making with customers. Aside from all that, the meeting is poorly run and ends with very little decided. I return to Barrington. About 4 p.m, I walk through the doors of the office building. The receptionist flags me down as I pass. She tells me Bob Donovan has asked to see me the moment I arrive. I have Bob paged, and he comes hurrying into my office a few minutes later. What's up, Bob?
Hilton Smythe. He was here in the plant today.
He was here? Why?
Well, you remember the videotape about robots that was in the works a couple of months ago?
Yeah, that was killed.
Yeah, well, it was reincarnated. Only now it's Hilton, because he's productivity manager for the division, doing the speech instead of Granby. I was having a cup of coffee out of the machine over by Sea Isle this morning, when I see this TV crew come trooping along. And by the time I found out what they were doing here, Hilton Smythe's standing at my elbow.
Didn't anybody here know they were coming?
Well, apparently Barbara Penn, our employee communicator, knew about it.
And she didn't think to tell anybody?
Well, see, the whole thing was rescheduled on short notice. Since you and Scott weren't around, she went ahead on her own, cleared it with the union, made all the arrangements. She apparently sent around a memo, but nobody got a copy until this morning.
Nothing like initiative. He goes on to tell me about how Hilton's crew proceeded to set up in front of one of the robots, not the welding types, but another kind of robot which stacks materials. It soon became obvious there was a problem, however. The robot didn't have anything to do. There was no inventory for it, and no work on its way. In a videotape about productivity, the robot, of course, could not simply sit there in the background and do nothing. It had to be producing. So for an hour, Donovan and a couple of assistants searched every corner of the plant for something the robot could manipulate. Meanwhile, Smythe became bored with the wait, so he started wandering around, and it wasn't long before he noticed a few things.
When we got back with the materials, Hilton started asking all kinds of questions about our batch sizes. I didn't know what to tell him, because I wasn't sure what you've set up at headquarters, and, I just thought you ought to know.
I feel my stomach twisting. Just then, the phone rings. I pick it up at my desk. It's Ethan Frost at headquarters. He tells me he's just had a talk with Hilton Smythe. I excuse myself to Bob, and he leaves. When he's gone and the door is shut, I talk to Frost for a couple of minutes and afterwards go down to see Lou. I walk through the door and start to tap dance. 2 days later, an audit team from headquarters arrives at the plant. The team is headed by the division's assistant controller, Neil Kravitz, a 50-ish man who has the wimpiest handshake and the most humorless stare of anyone I've ever met. They march in and take over the conference room. In hardly any time at all, they found we've changed the base for determining the cost of products.
This is highly irregular.
He's peering at us over the tops of his glasses, and he looks up from the spreadsheets. Lou stammers that, okay, maybe it wasn't exactly according to policy, but we had valid reasons for basing costs on a current 2-month period. It's actually a more truthful representation this way.
Sorry, Mr. Ruggo, we have to observe standard policy.
But the plant is different now. Around the table, all 5 accountants are frowning at Lou and me. I finally shake my head. There's no sense attempting to appeal to them. All they know are their accounting standards. The audit team recalculates the numbers, and it now looks as if our costs have gone up. When they leave, I try to head them off by calling Peach before they can return, but Peach is unexpectedly out of town. I try Frost, but he's gone too. One of the secretaries offers to put me through to Smythe, who seems to be the only manager in the offices. but I ungracefully decline. For a week, I wait for the blast from headquarters, but it never comes. Lou gets a rebuke from Frost in the form of a memo warning him to stick to approved policy and a formal order to redo our quarterly report according to the old cost standards and to submit it before the review. From Peach, there is nothing. I'm in the middle of a meeting with Lou over our revised monthly report early one afternoon. I'm crestfallen. With the numbers based on the old cost factor, we're not going to make our 15%. We're only going to record a 12.8% increase on the bottom line, not the 17% Lou originally calculated. Lou, can't we massage this a little more?
From now on, Frost is going to be scrutinizing everything we submit. I can't do any better than what you see now.
Just then, I become aware of the sound outside the offices that's getting louder and louder. I look at Lou, and he looks at me. Is that a helicopter? Lou goes to the window and looks out.
Sure is, and it's landing an hour long.
I get to the window just as it touches down. Dust and brown grass clippings are whirling in the prop wash around the sleek red and white helicopter, with the blade still twirling down to a stop. The door opens, and two men get out.
That first one looks like Johnny Johns.
It is Johnny Johns.
Who's the other guy?
I'm not sure. I watch them cross the lawn and start to walk through the parking lot. Something about the girth and the strident, arrogant swagger of the huge, white-haired second man triggers the recollection of a distant meeting. It dawns on me who he is. Oh, God.
I didn't think he needed a helicopter to get around.
It's worse than God. It's Bucky Burnside. Before Lou can utter another word, I'm running for the door. I dash around the corner and into Stacy's office. She, along with her secretary and some people she's meeting with, are all at the window. Everybody is watching the damn helicopter. Stacy, quick, I need to talk to you right now.
Yeah?
What's the status on Burnside's Model 12s?
The last shipment went out 2 days ago.
It was on time?
Sure. It went out the door with no problems, just like the previous shipments.
I'm running again, mumbling thanks over my shoulder to her. Donovan! He's not in his office. I stop at his secretary's desk. Where's Bob?
I think he went to the men's room.
I go sprinting in that direction. Bursting through the door, I find Bob washing his hands. On Burnside's order, were there any quality problems?
No, nothing I know about.
Were there any problems on that order? He reaches for a paper towel and dries his hands.
No, the whole thing came off like clockwork.
Then what the hell is he doing here?
Is who doing here?
Burnside! He just landed in a helicopter with Johnny Johns!
What?
Come with me! We go to the receptionist, but nobody's in the waiting area. Did Mr. Johns come through here just now with a customer?
The two men in the helicopter? No, I watched them and they went past here and into the plant.
Bob and I hustle side by side down the corridor and through the double doors into the orange light and production din of the plant. One of the supervisors sees us from across the aisle and, without being asked, points in the direction Johns and Burnside took. As we head down the aisle, I spot them ahead of us. Burnside is walking up to every employee he sees and he's shaking hands with each of them. Honest, he's shaking hands, clapping them on the arm, saying things to them, and he's smiling. Johns is walking with him. He's doing the same thing. As soon as Burnside lets go of a hand, Johns shakes it as well. They're pumping everybody in sight. Finally, John sees us approaching, taps Burnside on the shoulder, and says something to him. Burnside dons this big grin and comes striding up to me with his hand extended.
Here's the man I especially wanted to congratulate. I was saving the best for last, but you beat me to it. How are you?
Fine, just fine, Mr. Burnside.
Rugo, I came down here because I want to shake the hand of every employee in your whole plant. That was a hell of a job this plant did on our order. A hell of a good job. Those other bastards had the order for 5 months. I still couldn't get it down. And here your people finished the whole thing in 5 weeks. Must have been an incredible effort.
Bucky and I were having lunch today, and I was telling him how you pulled out all the stops for him. How everybody down here gave it everything they had.
Yeah, we just did our best.
Yeah, mind if I go ahead?
No, not at all.
Won't hurt your efficiency, will it?
Not one bit. You go right ahead. I turn to Donovan then, and out of the corner of my mouth say, get Barbara Penn down here right away with the camera she uses for the employee news, and tell her to bring lots of film. Donovan goes trotting off to the offices, and Johns and I follow Bucky up and down the aisles, the three of us shaking hands with one and all. Johnny, I notice, is a twitter with excitement. When Burnside is far enough ahead that he can't hear us, he turns to me.
What's your shoe size?
10.5. Why?
I owe you a pair of shoes.
That's okay, Johnny. Don't worry about it.
Al, I'm telling you, we're meeting with Burnside's people next week on a long-term contract for Model 12s.
10,000 units a year.
The number just about sends me reeling backwards.
And I'm calling in my whole department when we get back. We're going to do a new campaign pushing everything you make down here because this is the only plant we've got in this damn division that can ship a quality product on time. With your lead times out, we're going to blow everybody out of the market. Thanks to you, we finally got a winner.
Thanks, Johnny, but as it turned out, Burnside's order didn't take any extra effort at all.
Shh, don't let Burnside know.
Behind me, I hear two hourly guys talking.
What was that all about?
Beats me. Guess we must have done something right.
On the eve of the plant performance review, with presentation rehearsed and 10 copies of our report in hand, and with nothing more to do except imagine what could go wrong, I called Julie. Hi.
Hi.
Listen, I have to be at headquarters for a meeting tomorrow morning, and because Forest Grove is more or less on the way, I'd like to come up and be with you tonight. What do you think?
Sure, it sounds great.
So, I leave work a little early and hit the highway. As I head up the interstate, Barrington is spread out to my left. The Buy Me sign on top of the high-rise office building is still in place. Living and breathing within the range of my sight are 30,000 people who have no idea that one small but important part of the town's economic future will be decided tomorrow. Most of them haven't the slightest interest in the plant or what we've done here, except if Uniware closes us, they'll be mad and scared. And if we stay open, nobody will care. Nobody will even know what we went through. Well, win or lose, I know I did my best. When I get to Julie's parents' house, Sharon and Dave run up to the car. After getting out of my suit and into some off-duty clothes, I spend about an hour throwing a frisbee to the two kids. When they've exhausted me, Julie has the idea the two of us should go out to dinner. I get the feeling she wants to talk to me. I clean up a little and off we go. As we're driving along, we pass the park.
Al, why don't we stop for a while?
How come?
The last time we were here, we never finished our walk.
So I pull over, we get out and walk. By and by, we come to the bench by the river, and the two of us sit down.
What's your meeting about tomorrow?
It's a plant performance review. The division will decide the future of the plant.
Oh, what do you think they'll say?
Well, we didn't quite make what I promised Bill Peach. One set of numbers doesn't look as good as it truly is because of the cost of product standards. You remember me telling you about some of that, don't you? She nods. I shake my head momentarily, still angry at what happened as a result of the audit. But even with that, we still had a good month. It just doesn't show up as the fantastic month we really had.
You don't think they'd still close the plant, do you?
No, I don't think so. A person would have to be an idiot to condemn us just because of an increase in cost of products. Even with screwed-up measurements, we're making money. She reaches over to take my hand.
It was nice of you to take me out to breakfast that morning.
After listening to me ramble on at 5 o'clock in the morning, you deserved it.
When you talked to me then, it made me realize how little I know about what you do. I wish you had told me more over the years.
I don't know why I haven't. I guess I thought you wouldn't want to hear it, or I didn't want to burden you with it.
Well, I should have asked you more questions.
I'm sure I didn't give you many opportunities by working those long hours.
When you weren't coming home those days before I left, I really took it personally. I couldn't believe it didn't have something to do with me. Deep down, I thought you must be using it as an excuse to stay away from me.
No, absolutely not, Julie. When all those crises were occurring, I just kept thinking you must know how important they were. I'm sorry. I should have told you more. She squeezes my hand.
I've been thinking about some of the things you said about our marriage when we were sitting here last time. I have to say you're right. For a long time, we have just been coasting along. In fact, we were drifting apart. I've watched you get more and more wrapped up in your job as the years have gone by. And to compensate for losing you, I got wrapped up in things like decorating the house and spending my time with friends. We lost sight of what was important.
I look at her in the sunlight. The awful frosting in her hair, which she had when I came home the day the NCX-10 went down, is finally gone. It's grown out. Her hair is thick and straight again, and all the same dark brown.
Al, the one thing I definitely know now is that I want more of you, not less. That's always been the problem for me.
She turns to me with her blue eyes, and I get a long-lost feeling about her.
I finally figured out why I haven't wanted to go back to Barrington with you. And it isn't just the town, although I don't like it very much there. It's that since we've been living apart, we've actually spent more time being together. I mean, when we were living in the same house, I felt as though you took me for granted. Now you bring me flowers. You go out of your way to be with me. You take time to do things with me and the kids. Al, it's been nice. I know it can't go on this way forever. I think my parents are getting a little tired of the arrangement. But I haven't wanted it to end.
I start to feel very good. At least we're sure we don't want to say goodbye.
Al, I don't know exactly what our goal is, or ought to be, but I think we know there must be some kind of need between us. I know I want Sharon and Dave to grow up to be good people, and I want us to give each other what we need.
I put my arm around her. For starters, that sounds worth shooting for. Look, it's probably easier said than done, but I can certainly try to keep from taking you for granted. I'd like you to come home, but unfortunately, the pressures that caused all the problems are still going to be there. They're just not going to go away. I can't ignore my job.
I've never asked you to. Just don't ignore me or the kids, and I'll really try to understand your work.
You remember a long time ago, after we got married and we both had jobs, how we'd come home and just talk to each other for a couple of hours, sympathize with each other about the trials and tribulations we'd suffered during the day?
Mm-hmm.
That was nice.
But then there were the babies, and later you started putting in extra hours at work.
Yeah, we got out of the habit. What do you say we make a point to do that again?
That sounds terrific. Look, Al, I know that leaving you must have seemed selfish on my part. I just went crazy for a little while. I'm sorry.
No, you don't have to be sorry. I should have been paying attention.
But I'll try to make it up to you. Since we're walking down memory lane, maybe you remember the first fight we had, how we promised afterwards we'd always try to look at a situation from the other's point of view, as well as our own. Well, I think for the past couple of years, we haven't been doing that very often. I'm willing to try it again if you are.
I am too. There is a long hug. So, you want to get married?
I'll try anything twice.
You know, don't you? It's not going to be perfect. You know, we're still going to have fights.
And I'll probably be selfish about you from time to time.
What the hell? Let's go to Vegas and find a justice of the peace.
Are you serious?
Well, I can't go tonight. I've got that meeting in the morning. How about tomorrow night?
You are serious.
All I've been doing since you left is putting my paycheck in the bank. After tomorrow, it'll definitely be time to blow some of it.
Okay, big spender. Let's do it.
Chapter 31.
The next morning, on the 15th floor of the Unico building, I walk into the conference room at a few minutes before 10 o'clock. Sitting at the far end of the long table is Hilton Smythe, and sitting next to him is Neil Kravitz. Flanking them are various staff people. Good morning. Hilton looks up at me without a smile.
If you close the door, we can begin.
Wait a minute. Bill Peach isn't here yet. We're going to wait for him, aren't we?
Bill's not coming. He's involved in some negotiations.
I would like this review to be postponed until he's available. Smythe's eyes get steely.
Bill specifically told me to conduct this and to pass along my recommendation to him. So if you want to make a case for your plat, I suggest you get started. Otherwise, we'll have to draw our own conclusions from your report. With that increase in cost of products Neil has told us about, it sounds to me as if you have a little explaining to do. I, for one, would particularly like to know why you are not observing proper procedures for determining economical batch quantities.
I pace in front of them a moment before answering. The fuse to my anger has started a slow burn. I try to put it out and think about what this means. I don't like the situation one bit. Peach damn well ought to be here, and I was expecting to be making my presentation to Frost, not his assistant. But from the sound of it, Hilton may have set himself up with Peach to be my judge, jury, and possibly executioner. I decide the safest bet is to talk. Fine, but before I go into my presentation of what has been happening at my plant, let me ask you a question. Is it the goal of the Uniware division to reduce costs?
Of course it is.
No. Actually, that is not the goal. The goal of Uniware is to make money. Agreed? Kravitz sits up in his chair.
Well, that's true.
Hilton gives me a tentative nod. I'm going to demonstrate to you that regardless of what our costs look like according to standard measurements, my plant has never been in a better position to make money. And so it begins. An hour and a half later, I'm midway through an explanation of the effects of the bottlenecks upon inventory and throughput when Hilton stops me.
Okay, you've taken a lot of time to tell us all this, and I personally can't see the significance. Maybe at your plant you did have a couple of bottlenecks and you discovered what they were. Well, I mean, bravo and all that, but when I was a plant manager, we dealt with bottlenecks wandering everywhere.
Hilton, we're dealing with fundamental assumptions that are wrong.
I can't see that you're dealing with anything fundamental. It's at best simple common sense, and I'm being charitable at that.
No, it's more than just common sense, because we're doing things every day that are in direct contradiction to the established rules most people use in manufacturing.
Such as?
According to the cost accounting rules that everybody has used in the past, we're supposed to balance capacity with demand first, then try to maintain the flow. But instead, we shouldn't be trying to balance capacity at all. We need excess capacity. The rule we should be following is to balance the flow with demand, not the capacity. Two, the incentives we usually offer are based on the assumption that the level of utilization of any worker is determined by his own potential. That's totally false, because of dependency. For any resource that is not a bottleneck, the level of activity from which the system is able to profit is not determined by its individual potential, but by some other constraint within the system.
What's the difference? When somebody is working, we're getting use out of him.
No, and that's a third assumption that's wrong. We've assumed that utilization and activation are the same. Activating a resource and utilizing a resource are not synonymous. And the argument goes on. I say an hour lost at a bottleneck is an hour out of the entire system. Hilton says an hour lost at a bottleneck is just an hour lost of that resource. I say an hour saved at a non-bottleneck is worthless. Hilton says an hour saved at a non-bottleneck is an hour saved at that resource.
All this talk about bottlenecks. Bottlenecks temporarily limit throughput. Maybe your plant is proof of that. But they have little impact upon inventory.
It's completely the opposite, Hilton. Bottlenecks govern both throughput and inventory. And I'll tell you what my plant really has shown. It's proved our performance measurements are wrong. Kravitz drops the pen he's holding, and it rolls noisily on the table.
Then how are we to evaluate the performance of our operations?
By the bottom line. And based upon that evaluation, my plant has now become the best in the Uniware division, and possibly the best in its industry. We're making money when none of the others are.
Temporarily, you may be making money. But if you're really running your plant this way, I can't possibly see how your plant can be profitable for very long.
Oh, Hilton, obviously.
The fact of the matter is that your cost of products measurement increased. And when costs go up, profits have to go down. It's that simple. And that's the basis of what I'll be putting into my report to Bill Peach.
Afterwards, I find myself alone in the room. Mr. Smythe and Kravitz have gone. I'm staring into my open briefcase. Then, with a fist, I slam it shut. I'm muttering to myself something about their pig-headedness as I exit the conference room and go to the elevators. I press the down button, but when the elevator arrives, I'm not there. I'm walking back up the corridor again, and I'm heading for the corner office. Bill's secretary, Meg, watches me approach. I stride up to her desk where she's sorting paper clips.
I need to see Bill.
Go right in. He's waiting for you.
Hello, Al. I knew you wouldn't leave without seeing me. Take a seat.
Hilton Smythe is going to submit a negative report about my plant, and I feel that as my manager, you should hear me out before you come to any conclusions.
Go ahead. Tell me all about it. Sit down. We're not in a rush.
I continue to talk. Bill puts his elbows on the desktop and his fingers together in front of his face. Finally, I stop.
And you explained all of this to Hilton.
In great detail.
And what was his response?
He basically refused to listen. He continues to claim that as long as cost of products increase, profits eventually have to go down.
Don't you think he has a point?
No, I don't. As long as I keep my operating expenses under control and Johnny Johns is happy, I don't see how profits can help but continue to go up.
Fine. Can you call Hilton, Nathan, and Johnny Johns in here, please?
What's going on?
Don't worry. Just wait and see.
It's not long before they all enter the room and take seats.
Hilton, you've heard Alex's report this morning. You've also seen all the financial results. As the productivity manager of the division and as a fellow plant manager, what's your recommendation?
I think that Alex should be called to order. And I think that immediate action should be taken in his plant before it's too late. The productivity in Alex's plant is deteriorating. Cost of products is going up. and proper procedures are not being followed. I think that immediate actions are in order. And what about the fact that in the last 2 months, that plant has turned profits rather than losses, while releasing a lot of cash for the division? That is only a temporary phenomenon. We must expect big losses in the very near future.
Johnny, do you have anything to add?
Yes, certainly. Alex's plant is the only one that can produce miracles, to deliver what the client needs in a surprisingly short time. You've all heard about Burnside's visit. With such a plant backing up sales, they can really go out and blast the market.
Yes, but at what price? Cutting batches to far below optimum size, devoting the entire plant to one order? Do you know the long-term ramifications?
But I haven't devoted the plant to one order. As a matter of fact, I haven't got any past due orders. All my clients are pleased.
Miracles exist only in fairy tales.
So, what's the verdict? Is my plant going to be closed?
No. Not at all. Do you think we're such bad managers that we would close a gold mine?
I sigh in relief. Only now do I notice I've been holding my breath.
As manager of productivity of the division, I feel it's my duty to protest.
Bill ignores him and turns to Nathan and Johnny.
Shall we tell them now or wait until Monday? Hilton, this morning I asked you to sit in for me because Nathan, Johnny, and I were at a meeting with Granby. 2 months from now, the three of us are moving up the ladder to head the group. Granby left it to us to decide who will be the next manager of the division. And I think that the three of us have decided. Congratulations, Alex. You will be the one to replace me.
When I return to the plant, Fran hands me a message.
It's from Bill Peach. What's going on?
Call everybody. I have some good news. Bill's message is, I recommend you use these 2 months to prepare yourself. You still have a lot to learn, hotshot. At last, I'm able to reach Jonah in New York and fill him in on the latest developments. Although pleased for me, he does not seem surprised. And all this time, I was just worried about saving my one plant. Now it seems that I'm ending up with three.
Good luck. Keep up the good work.
Jonah, wait. I'm afraid that luck will not be enough. I'm out of my depth. Can't you come down and help me? I haven't spent 2 hours tracking down Jonah just to hear his congratulations. Frankly, I'm terrified at the prospect of my new job. It's one thing to handle a production plant, but handling a division of three plants does not mean just three times the work. It also means responsibility for product design and marketing.
Even if I had the time, I don't think it's a good idea.
Why not? It seemed to work fine so far.
Alex, as you climb up the ladder and your responsibilities grow, you should learn to rely more and more on yourself. Asking me to come now will lead to the opposite. It will increase the dependency.
I refuse to see his point. Can't you continue to teach me?
Yes, I can. But first, you should find out exactly what it is that you want to learn. Call me then.
I want to learn how to run an efficient division. Isn't it obvious?
Well, in the past, you wanted to learn how to run an efficient plant. Now you want to learn how to run an efficient division. We both know that it will not end here. What is it that you want to learn? Can you spell it out?
Actually, I guess that I want to learn how to manage a plant, a division, a company, any type or size organization. And it wouldn't be bad to learn how to manage my life, but I'm afraid that that would be asking for too much.
Why too much? I think that every sensible person should want to learn how to manage his or her life.
Great. When can we start?
Now. Your first assignment is to find out what techniques are needed for effective management.
What?
Come on, I didn't ask you to develop them, just to determine clearly what they should be. Call me when you have the answer. And Alex, congratulations on your promotion.
Chapter 32.
I'm really proud of you. Three more steps like that and we will have made it. Shall we drink to it?
Julie's forced enthusiasm strikes a responding chord inside me. No, I don't think so. I refuse the toast, an event which, as you can imagine, is not very common. Julie doesn't say a word. She just slowly lowers her drink, leans slightly forward, and looks directly into my eyes. It's quite apparent that she's waiting for some explanation. Under the pressure, I start to talk slowly, trying to verbalize my rambling thoughts. Julie, I really don't think that we should toast it, at least not in the way you make it sound, like toasting an empty victory. Somehow, I feel like you were right all along. What is this promotion, if not just winning a point in the rat race? My wife can express herself very clearly without even opening her mouth, which is definitely not the case for me. Here I am, rambling all over the place. Rat race. Empty victory. What on earth am I talking about? But still, why do I feel it's inappropriate to toast my promotion? The family paid too big a price for this promotion.
Alex, you're being too hard on yourself. This crisis was about to explode one way or the other. I gave it a lot of thought, and let's face it, if you had given up, the feeling of failure would have spoiled every good part of our marriage. I think you should be proud of this promotion. You didn't step on anybody to get it. You won it fair and square.
A chill goes down my back as I remember it. I was in deep trouble. My plant was under a real threat of being closed down. Over 600 people were about to join the already long unemployment lines. My career was one inch from being kissed by limbo. And on top of all that, the unbelievable hours I was putting in at work had pushed our marriage to the brink of going down the tube. In short, I was about to change from a bright rising star into an ordinary bum. But I didn't give up. Against all odds, I continued to fight, and I was not alone. Jonah introduced me to his common sense and thus very controversial approach to managing a company. It made a lot of sense, so my team enthusiastically backed me up. And it was fun, real fun. Let me tell you, the last few months were quite stormy. I think that we violated almost every rule of corporate America. But we made it. We turned the plant around. So much so that it saved the entire division. Now, Julie and I are sitting in this fancy restaurant celebrating. I'm going to head the division, which means relocation, a fact that probably contributes a lot to Julie's supportive mood. Julie, let's drink to my promotion. Not as a step toward the tip of the pyramid, but let's drink to what it really means. Positive reassurance to our exciting, worthwhile journey. A broad smile is spreading over Julie's face, and our glasses make a clear, gentle sound. We turn to our menus in a good mood. It's your celebration as much as it is mine. Actually, it's much more Jonah's achievement than mine.
You know, Alex, it's so typical of you. You work so hard, and now you want to give the credit to somebody else?
Julie, I'm serious. Jonah is the one who gave me all the answers. I was just the instrument. As much as I would like to think otherwise, that's the plain, bare truth.
No, it's far from the truth.
But...
Alex, stop this nonsense. Artificial modesty doesn't suit you. Nobody handed you solutions on a silver platter. Tell me, Mr. Rogo, how many nights did you sweat until you succeeded in finding the answers?
Quite a few.
You see?
No, I don't see. I'm very well aware that Jonah didn't simply give me the answers. As a matter of fact, during those long nights and days, considerable time was spent cursing him for just that. But come on, Julie. The fact that he elected to present them in the form of very pointed questions doesn't change a thing. Rather than continuing, Julie calls the waiter and starts to order. She's right. This line of discussion will just ruin a pleasant evening. It's not until I'm busy with my delicious veal parmesan that my thoughts start to crystallize. What was the nature of the answers, the solutions that Jonah caused us to develop? They all had one thing in common. They all made common sense. And at the same time, they flew directly in the face of everything I'd ever learned. Would we have had the courage to try to implement them if it weren't for the fact that we'd had to sweat to construct them? Most probably not. If it weren't for the conviction that we gained in the struggle, for the ownership that we developed in the process, I don't think we'd actually have had the guts to put our solutions into practice. Still deep in thought, I raise my eyes from the plate and examine Julie's face. It's as if she were waiting for me all this time.
How come you didn't think of it yourselves? To me, your answers look like plain common sense. Why couldn't you do it without Jonah's guiding questions?
Good question. Very good question. Frankly, I doubt I know the answer.
Alex, don't tell me you haven't thought about it.
Yes, I have. All of us, back in the plant, had the same question. The solutions look trivial, but the fact is that for years we've done the exact opposite. Moreover, the other plants still insist on sticking to the old, devastating ways. Probably Mark Twain was right, saying that common sense is not common at all, or something similar.
That's not an answer to my question.
She won't let me off the hook. Just bear with me. I really don't know. I'm not sure that I even know the meaning of common sense. What do you think we mean when we refer to something as common sense?
It's unfair to answer a question with a question.
Why not? She doesn't allow her lips to move. Okay. The best that I've come up with so far is to recognize that we refer to something as common sense if it is in line with our own intuition. Which only helps to intensify your question. It only means that when we recognize something as common sense, it must be that, at least intuitively, we knew it all along. Why is there so often the need for an external trigger to help us realize something that we already knew intuitively?
That was my question.
Yes, darling, I know. Probably these intuitive conclusions are masked by something else, something that's not common sense.
What could that be?
Probably common practice.
Ah, makes sense.
I must admit that Jonah's way of leading to the answers through asking questions, his Socratic approach, is very effective at peeling away the layers, the thick layers, of common practice. I tried to explain the answers to others who needed them as badly as we did, but got nowhere. As a matter of fact, if it hadn't been for Nathan Frost's appreciation of our improvements to the bottom line, my approach might have led to some very undesirable results. You know, it's amazing how deeply ingrained those things are that we've been told and practiced, but never spent the time to think about on our own. Don't give the answers, just ask the questions. I'll have to practice that. What's the matter?
Nothing.
Don't give the answers. Definitely makes sense. Spelling out the answers when you are trying to convince someone who blindly follows the common practice is totally ineffective. Actually, there are only two possibilities. Either you are not understood, or you are understood.
You don't say.
In the first case, no real harm has been done. People are just going to ignore you. The second case might be much worse. People might understand you. They'll take your message as something worse than criticism.
What is worse than criticism?
Constructive criticism. You have a point, but it's below the belt. People will never forgive you for that.
Alex, you don't have to convince me that when I want to persuade somebody, especially my husband, that giving answers is not the way. I'm simply not convinced that only asking questions is much better.
She's right. Whenever I tried just to ask questions, it was interpreted as patronizing, or even worse, that I was simply negative. It looks like one should think twice before charging the tall windmills of common practice. Julie busies herself with the delicious cheesecake our waiter is placing in front of us. I do the same. When the coffee's served, I gather enough stamina to continue. Julie, is it really so bad? I don't recall giving you a lot of grief.
Are you kidding? Not only are you stubborn like a southern mule, you had to go and pass on these genes to your kids. I bet you gave Jonah a hard time as well.
No, Julie, with Jonah, somehow it was different. You see, whenever I'm talking with Jonah, I have the distinct feeling that not only is he ready with his questions, he's also ready with my questions. It must be that the Socratic method is much more than just asking questions. One thing I can tell you, improvising with this method is hazardous. Believe me, I've tried. It's like throwing a sharpened boomerang. Then it dawns on me. Here's the answer. This is the technique that I should ask Jonah to teach me. How to persuade other people. How to peel away the layers of common practice. How to overcome the resistance to change. I tell Julie about my last telephone conversation with Jonah.
Oh, that's very interesting. You definitely need to learn how to manage your life better. But, sweetheart, be careful. Remember what happened to Socrates. He was forced to drink poison.
I don't intend giving Jonah any poison. Julie, let me tell you. Whenever Jonah and I talked about my troubles at the plant, I always felt he anticipated my response. It actually bothered me for quite some time.
Why?
When did he have time to learn so much? I'm not talking about theories. I'm talking about his intimate understanding of how the wheels are really turning in a plant. As far as I know, he never worked one day of his life in industry. He's a physicist. I can't believe that a scientist sitting in his ivory tower can know so much about the detailed realities of the shop floor. Something doesn't match.
Alex, if that's the case, it seems that you should ask Jonah to teach you something more than just the Socratic method.
Chapter 33.
Lou is my first and most important target. If I'm unable to persuade him to join me, I'm basically lost. It's not going to be easy. He's very close to retirement, and I know to what extent he's involved in his community. I take a deep breath and walk into his office. Hey, Lou, is it a good time?
Good as any. How can I help you?
Perfect opening. But somehow, I don't have the guts to go straight to the point. I was wondering about your forecast for the next 2 months. Do you see any problem in us reaching and maintaining the 15% net profit? Not that it's crucial anymore, but I'd hate giving Hilton Smythe even the slightest opening to his, "I told you so."
You can sleep tight. According to my calculations, we'll easily cross the 20% net profit for the next 2 months.
What? Lou, what's the matter with you? Since when do you believe marketing's chronically optimistic outlook?
Alex, a lot has happened to me recently, but believing marketing is not one of them. Actually, my forecast is based on a slight decline in incoming orders.
So, how did you pull this rabbit out of your hat?
Have a seat. It'll take me some time to explain. I have something important to tell you.
It's clear that I'm going to hear about another devious accounting trick. All right, let's hear it.
Alex, we blame the distorted way in which product costs are calculated for giving the appearance that our net profit was only 12.8%, rather than over 17% as we believed was the case. I know that you are furious about it, but what I've found out is that there's an even bigger accounting distortion. It's tied to the way that we evaluate inventory, but it's hard for me to explain. Maybe I'll try to do it through the balance sheet.
He pauses. I wait patiently.
Maybe I should start with a question. Do you agree that inventory is a liability?
Of course. Everybody knows that. And even if we didn't know it, the last few months have shown to what extent inventory is a liability. Do you think we could have pulled off this fast response to orders if the floor had been as jammed up as before? And haven't you noticed that quality has improved and overtime has gone down, not to mention that we hardly ever have to expedite today?
Yeah. Inventory is definitely a liability, but under what heading are we forced to report it on the balance sheet?
Holy cow, Lou! I knew that the financial measurements were remote from reality, but to that extent, to report liabilities under the heading of assets, I never realized the full implications. Tell me, what are the bottom line ramifications?
Bigger than you think, Alex. I've checked and rechecked it, but the numbers do talk. You see, we're evaluating inventory according to the cost to produce the goods. These costs include not only the money we pay for the raw materials, but also the value added in production. You know what we have done in the last few months. Donovan has worked only on things that we have orders for. Stacy has released material accordingly. We've drained about 50% of the work in process from the plant, and about 25% from finished goods. We've saved a lot by not purchasing new materials to replace this excess inventory, and the cash figures show it clearly. But on our books, the assets represented by inventory went down, since they were only partially compensated for by the cash we didn't have to pay out. In this period, when we were reducing inventory, all the difference between the product cost and the material cost of the reduced inventory showed up as a net loss.
Lou, you're telling me that we were penalized for doing the right thing? That reducing the excess inventory was interpreted by our books as a loss?
Yes.
Well, tell me, what was the impact in numbers?
Our actual net profit was well over 20% in each of the last 3 months.
I stare at him. I can't believe my ears.
But look at the good side. Now that the inventory has stabilized at a new low level, this effect won't disturb us any longer.
Thank you very much. Hey, Lou, when did you discover this phenomena? When did you find out that we were turning much more profit than the targeted 15%?
A week ago.
So why didn't you tell me? I could have used these facts very effectively in the plant review.
No, Alex, you couldn't have used them at all. It just would have confused your story. You see, everyone evaluates inventory this way. It's even required by the tax authorities. You didn't stand a chance. But I did discuss it at length with Nathan Frost. He understood it perfectly.
So that's what happened, you fox. Now I understand why Nathan became so supportive.
Alex, I have another issue.
Another bomb?
You might call it that, but it's sort of a personal matter. Nathan told me that he's going with Bill Peach to the group. I know that you'll need a good divisional controller, someone who has experience in the more diverse subjects that are dealt with at the division level. I'm just 1 year from retirement. Everything that I know is old-fashioned, so...
Here it comes. I must stop him before he states that he doesn't want to come with me. Once he says it, it'll be much harder to change his mind. Lou, wait. Look at the work that we've done in the last few months. Don't you think...
That's exactly what I was about to bring up. Look at it from my point of view. All my life, I've gathered numbers and compiled reports. I've seen myself as somebody who has to supply the data, as an impartial, objective observer. But the last few months have shown me to what extent I was wrong. I wasn't an objective observer. I was following almost blindly some erroneous procedures without understanding the far-reaching, devastating ramifications. I've given it a lot of thought lately. We need financial measurements for sure, but we don't need them for their own sake. We need them for two different reasons. One is control, knowing to what extent a company is achieving its goal of making money. The other reason is probably even more important. Measurements should induce the parts to do what's good for the organization as a whole. What's become apparent to me is that neither of these two objectives is being met. For example, this conversation we just had. We knew very well that the plant had drastically improved, but the distorted measurements have almost condemned us. I'm submitting efficiency reports, product cost reports, and now we both know to what extent they just lead workers and management alike to do what's bad for the company.
I've never heard Lou talk for so long. I agree with everything he just said, but I'm totally confused. I don't know what he's getting at.
Alex, I can't stop here. I can't retire now. Do me a personal favor. Take me with you. I want the opportunity to devise a new measurement system, one that'll correct the system we have now, so that it will do what we expect it to do, so that a controller can be proud of his job. I don't know if I'll succeed, but at least give me the chance.
What am I supposed to say? It's a deal! Back at my desk, I ask Fran to call Donovan in. With Lou on one side and Bob on the other, I'll be free to concentrate on the two areas I know the least, engineering and marketing. What am I going to do about marketing? The only person I appreciate in that department is Johnny Johns. No wonder Bill has decided to take him along.
Hey, Al, I'm sitting with Stacy and Ralph. We really cook it. Can you join us?
How long will it take?
No way to tell. Probably till the end of the day.
In that case, I'll pass. But, Bob, we need to talk. Can you get away for a few minutes?
Sure, no problem.
And in no time, he enters my office.
What's up, boss?
How'd you like to be responsible for all production of the division?
Wow.
Well, Bob, surprised?
You bet.
I go to pour us coffee, and he starts to talk to my back.
Alex, I don't want that job. Not now. You know, a month ago, I would have grabbed the offer with both hands. It's way beyond what I expected.
Puzzled, I turn around, a cup in each hand. What's the matter, Bob? Afraid?
You know better than that.
So what happened in the past month to change your perspective?
Burnside.
You mean he made you a better offer?
No, Alex, nothing like that. What gave me a new perspective was the way we handled Burnside's urgent order. I learned so much from how we handled that case that I'd rather stay in this plant and develop it further.
Surprises all around me. I thought I knew these people. I expected it would be impossible to convince Lou, and he almost begged me for the job. I didn't expect any problems with Bob, and he just declined my offer. It's really annoying. You'd better explain.
Well, haven't you noticed how unique the events of Burnside's order were?
Yes, of course. I've never heard of the president of a company going to thank the workers of a vendor.
Yeah, that too. But look at the whole chain of events. Johnny called you with an impossible client wish. He didn't believe it could be done, and neither did the client. And on the surface, it was impossible. But we looked into it. We considered the bottleneck availability, we considered the vendor limitations, and we came back with something pretty unusual. We didn't say a flat no or a flat yes, and then missed the due date by a mile as we used to do. We re-engineered the deal. We came back with a counteroffer that was feasible and that the client liked even more than his original request.
Yes, it was good work. Especially considering what came out after that. But that was a peculiar set of circumstances.
It was peculiar because normally we don't take the initiative. But maybe there's a way to make it standard. Don't you see? We actually engineered a sale. We in the plant in production engineered a sale.
I think about it. He's right. Now I start to see where he's heading.
For you, it's not a big deal. You always look at production and sales as two links in the same chain. But look at me. All the time I'm buried out on the shop floor, thinking that my responsibility is to put out fires, and viewing the sales department as snake oil salesmen, spreading unrealistic promises to our clients. For me, this event was a revelation. Look, we give sales a rigid lead time for each product. So, if it's not in finished goods, those are the numbers they should use to promise the clients. Yeah, they deviate from it, but not by much. Maybe there should be another way. Maybe the quoted lead time should be done case by case, according to the load on the bottlenecks. And maybe we shouldn't regard the quantities required as if we have to supply them in one shot. Alex, I'd like to look into it more. Actually, that's what Stacy, Ralph, and I were doing right now. We were looking for you. You should join us. It's pretty exciting.
It certainly sounds it, but I can't allow myself to get sucked in right now. I have to continue with preparations for my next job. Tell me again.